This is Midday Magazine for Thursday, April 21st. For KFSK News, I'm Tom Abbott. How many wolves are on Prince of Wales Island? It's an important question because wolves are an important predator, part of the chain of life in the forest. A POW tribal group has been awarded a federal grant to help gather data to determine that number. Layla Carey has this report.
The state of Alaska conducts population studies on Prince of Wales, but on a relatively small portion of that very large island. State biologists then use data from that study to estimate how many wolves are in the entire game unit, which also includes some outlying islands. It's a standard accepted practice for population studies, but there are obvious limits. To enhance the state's study, Heidelberg Cooperative Association applied for and received a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Tribal Wildlife Grant to pay for additional population studies in the area around Heidelberg in the southwest part of POW. Tony Christensen runs the Natural Resources Program for the tribe. He says the wolf population study was a priority.
The wolf brings a balance to the resource and has its place in southeast and, you know, the state, but more importantly is the deer, you know, for us is the deer. And, you know, if that population of wolf isn't maintained in a healthy population, then we can have an issue with the deer population in our area.
Christensen says the Heidelberg study will be modeled on the state's study, so the results from both can be combined to provide a more complete picture. He believes the state's chosen study area limits the accuracy of the data.
It's road accessible, you know, in areas of high harvest for other resources, and with that comes human traffic, and everybody knows wolves, they tend to shy away from where humans are. And so the Heidelberg area is less populated with less roaded area.
Alaska Fish and Game last year released the findings from its most recent POW wolf population study, and its results were sobering. The study indicated a significant drop in the number of wolves, 89 in the entire game management unit compared to 221 the prior year. State and federal officials use population estimates to set hunting and trapping limits, so last season's wolf hunt on POW was limited to 9 animals. But Christensen says he thinks there are more wolves than the state study shows.
We have observations and have a sense that the population is considerably higher than 90 animals, but, you know, we just rather than voice that, we wanted to try to involve ourselves in finding out what the answer is.
The tribe will work with Fish and Game and local hunters to plan the study. Those plans will take shape over the summer, with most field work happening in the fall. That primarily involves hair boards, pieces of wood with some barbs on them, scented to attract wolves. The wolves roll on the boards, leaving behind hair samples, and the biologists then use the hair to conduct DNA tests. That way they identify how many individual animals have rolled on the boards and use that for a population analysis. Once the samples have been collected, they'll be sent to the state, and it'll take a while for the results.
So you take the hair and send it off to a lab, and they process it and analyze it, and I guess, you know, there's more than just wolf that roll over your scent boards, and so they have to decipher wolf and other game animals and then come back to you with a conclusion. I would assume it would be next year sometime.
We're still waiting on the data from the DNA work from the laboratory from last fall's work.
That's Ryan Scott, the Southeast Regional Supervisor for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, confirming that analysis will take a while. Scott says he's pleased that Heidelberg is going to provide additional data for the Prince of Wales Island wolf population study. He says the department hasn't had the resources to expand the work, although officials have wanted to for a while.
And cooperatively working with the Heidelberg Corporation is a great way to do that.
Scott says the state's previous studies are based on best practices, and it's accepted among biologists with the understanding that there are limitations. And in fact, the estimate last fall of 89 wolves was just the midpoint of a range. The state study shows the population could have been as low as 50 or as high as 159. Increasing the study area will be great, Scott says.
But again, I would say that the way that the department has approached it, previous to, you know, what we do in the coming year, is okay too. It's the right way to go, given time, money, and resources. So this is just, I mean, it certainly will make a much more robust estimate, and it's very appreciated.
Christensen says he just wants to make sure the wolf hunt is set at a level that ensures the continued viability of deer on Prince of Wales.
Yep, deer is a huge part of our community culture and a huge part of our dietary needs there, and it fills the freezers. It's basically entwined into the culture. It's what we eat is deer meat, deer meat and fish.
The federal grant paying for the Heidelberg portion of the study is just shy of $140,000. It was one of several grants recently awarded by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to tribes in Alaska. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Federal fishery biologists expect only 30 million pink salmon will be harvested in Alaska this season. That's well short of last season's disappointing harvest of 34 million fish and 2013's record catch of 95 million pinks. As part of a post-mortem on last year's salmon runs, Matt Miller visited a weir near Juneau that has been recording salmon going out and coming back earlier and earlier for the last 35 years.
Last year's pink salmon runs in southeast Alaska weren't horrible, but they weren't great either. It actually made a big difference where the fish returned in the panhandle.
Northern and southeast turned out good, above average, but southern and southeast just tanked.
Joe Orsi, a research fisheries biologist at National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute in Juneau, speculates that warm sea surface temperatures may be responsible for last year's high survival rates or larger fish size, but those results were not universal for all southeast Alaska pink runs.
Basically, it's about a million or so fish higher than the 10-year average in northern southeast, but southern southeast Alaska, it's been like 10 million below the 10-year average. So there appears to be like a split in the production survival of pink salmon about in the middle of southeast Alaska.
Prince William Sound and Kodiak pink runs also came in strong. But why? For now, Orsi says they can only speculate on the reasons.
I know they had a lot of flooding events last winter down there. That's a possibility. There could have been a mismatch of the fish entering the marine environment and the timing of the zooplankton down there. There could have been an assortment of predators or competitors that came up with the warm blob that may have impacted the juvenile salmon. There's just a lot of unknowns.
Pink salmon returning to southeast Alaska in 2015 were the children of 2013's big return that formed the basis for that season's record 95 million fish harvest. Orsi earlier predicted that 54 million pinks would be harvested, and going off his numbers, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game forecasted a range of 37 to 58 million fish that would be taken by all gear types, but only about 34 million fish were caught, and Orsi concedes he was way off.
As you know, we predicted a fairly good pink salmon return to southeast Alaska, and I kind of have to face the music here, and we didn't get that strong return.
It's still unclear whether a persistent warm water anomaly, nicknamed the blob, or developing El Nino had any impact on those runs. Hawk Creek is just one example of how some streams in northern southeast had better returns than other streams further south. The Hawk Creek Weir and Hatchery is a small, federally operated facility tucked away in the woods in the 1,500 feet between Hawk Lake and Hawk Bay in Juneau. John Joyce, one of Orsi's colleagues, is a research fisheries biologist also at the Ted Stevens Marine Research Institute, and he spends a lot of his time at the weir. He says local geography and the relatively low drainage area are big factors in the health of the system.
Flow is very important.
A low snowpack in the Hawk Lake drainage melted early in March and April last year. That was followed by a very dry May and then a heavy rain by July.
So all that affects not only the flow in the creek, but also the temperature. And temperature and flow are really important factors for fish that migrate, juveniles and adults.
Joyce uses words like phenomenal and incredible to describe over 24,000 big pinks that returned to Auk Creek last summer. That's over a 51% marine survival rate for the 47,000 juvenile salmon that passed out of Auk Creek and into the ocean the previous year. Normal survival rates for returning salmon range from a 0.1% to just 10%, not 51%. The Auk Creek facility is unique because biologists have data on stream flow and water temperatures that correspond with 35 years of continuously counting salmon. And Joyce says they noticed silver returns have been compressed into a largely two-week period, while pink runs have trended 2 weeks earlier over the last three decades.
But it's substantial, and it has ecological implications too, because these juveniles have adapted a certain timing to enter the ocean. Well, that adaptation to timing could be differently influenced in freshwater than saltwater. So you potentially have, you know, a mismatch thing where they're going faster in freshwater, but the ocean's not ready for them.
Joyce says their research into migratory behavior and ocean survival has implications for resource management.
If you have salmon that used to run over a month and you could access them and now they're running over 2 weeks, it affects your ability to harvest, it affects predators' ability to kill, you know, so it does have impacts in terms of ecological impacts in terms of the systems too.
Joyce says they're collaborating with the University of Alaska Southeast, which is using their 35-year data sets in their research to determine how climate change is influencing migratory behavior, marine survival, and productivity. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
A new science club in Petersburg is hoping to spur curiosity and even passion about marine science among middle schoolers. KFSK's Angela Denning has more.
It literally looks, feels like a tissue.
A group of middle school students is hovering around trays of slimy, foot-long squid in the high school science room. They've been meeting here every Wednesday after school. Today, in white paper aprons, they're learning about squid anatomy from instructor Joni Johnson.
So you guys, the first thing I want you to do is go ahead before we mess with it too much. It's kind of crazy. Just look at the skin. What do you see? And I shouldn't say the skin.
Like bumps.
I see speckles.
Bumps and speckles?
Yeah.
Okay. They're not. They're kind of like pores, but they're different. So go ahead, and granted, these have been in the freezer, but I wanted you to take your two fingers, and you're going to give this guy a massage and see what happens when you rub it like crazy. Gently, not hard, but what do you see happening? Keep rubbing.
It changes color.
Oh, mine's getting really dark.
Mm-hmm. Male squid, believe it or not, if you just look down the midline, they'll actually, if they're trying to fend off another male, they'll take one half of their body, it's black, the other half is white. And they keep the white so that all the other males, like, back off. And then if the male comes around to the other side, they could move, but no, they just automatically switch colors. And so now this side's black and your other side's white. Can you imagine doing that?
The students take the squid in their hands and hold it head up, letting the tentacles fall around the side. The insides of an animal aren't unknown to many of the students. They've grown up cleaning fish and game.
Inside of the mantle and slice away from you, but with the blade up, just like when you're gutting a deer. Because if you
are still, there is some squeamishness in the group.
Finger doesn't fit in there.
I can't put my pinky in there.
Most of the kids are sixth graders. Petersburg has long had a high school science club known as the NOSB team, which stands for National Ocean Science Bowl Team. This spring, a program for middle school students began.
You know, part of it's just purely selfish. We want to build interest. It's like a feeder program for our high school.
That's Sunny Rice, the other instructor. She's been coaching the high school team along with Johnson for about 7 years. But hanging out in the science room, it doesn't take long to realize that it's more than just recruiting. There's a real excitement floating around with Rice and Johnson and the new students.
So those are the arms to grab on. And then the tentacles that have the suction cups the whole length, there are eight of them. That's how they wrap it up and they bring it to the beak.
The middle school science program begins on the heels of the high school's National Ocean Science Bowl season. The finale for the high schoolers is a trip to the statewide competition in Seward. A main component of that meet is the Science Bowl trivia game. Like Jeopardy, students hit buzzers to answer questions. It's something that the coaches want to practice with the middle school students every week.
So they need to know the answer to the question, but they also need to be able to think really fast about the answer to that question because it's all about timing, and then they need to be able to buzz really quickly. You know, there's a lot of skills that actually go into the simple act of participating in the buzzer round, so we can start getting them those skills now.
Okay. So toss up multiple choice. What percentage of the Earth's water is contained in glaciers and polar ice caps? W, 0.2%, X, 2.2%, Y, 22%, that's an interrupt, Bergen.
2.2%.
Correct. Your bonus question.
Rice says it's a learning process. They'll be accumulating science knowledge as they go. And undoubtedly, facts about squid will be asked in the coming weeks. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
Ketchikan International Airport is just a few weeks away from switching its heat source to a high-efficiency biomass boiler system. Layla Carey hopped the ferry to Gravina Island to see the new system and has this report.
On the ferry with me is Karen Peterson. She was in town for a quick visit from Prince of Wales Island, specifically to see the airport's new biomass boiler.
I work for the University of Alaska Cooperative Extension Service, and I chair the Alaska Wood Energy Development Task Group.
That group of about 20 evaluates applications from public agencies statewide for grants related to biomass heating systems. The Ketchikan Gateway Borough was one of those applicants, and 4 years ago, its grant was approved. The borough used the funds for a feasibility study and then successfully applied for a federal woody bug.
A woody bug, wood biomass utilization grant, right? And now they are constructing and installing this wood heat system, and it's pretty cool.
That grant, along with much larger state grants, paid for the biomass boiler project, which also includes an oil-fired backup boiler, a building to house them both, and a silo that holds about 30 tons of pellets at a time.
Thank you.
After paying the toll for our short ferry ride to Gravina Island, where Ketchikan's airport is located, we meet up with airport manager Mike Carney.
I brought Layla Carey with me.
Oh, yeah.
She wanted to do a quick story about it. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Yeah, let's go down there.
He takes us to a new green-sided building that houses the boiler, which is pretty small considering that it will heat the entire airport. But as Peterson explains in the elevator on our way over, some of the problems other facilities have had with their biomass boilers are because the boilers are too big.
The problem that engineers have is if a little one is good, then a big one is better. But it does not hold true for biomass boilers that work efficiently when they're working at full speed.
100%.
Yep, and so it's better to put in a small one that works 100% and then supplement it.
A small boiler running at full capacity is more efficient because it's running constantly. Starting and stopping is where efficiency is lost. And to maximize efficiency even more, there's a 1,200-gallon thermal storage tank.
So the boiler is going to heat the water in the thermal storage, and that's what its job is just to keep this tank hot all the time. And what that means is it's going to keep this, what is it, set at 175 or 180 degrees?
Yeah.
Something like that. And it's going to keep this constantly, and then the heat from the building is going to draw off of this thermal storage through heat exchangers.
Carney says that even with the extremely low current price of oil, he expects the new boiler will save the borough in fuel costs. Locally owned Tongass Forest Enterprises has the contract to deliver the airport's pellets at a cost of about $300 a ton. They've budgeted for 100 tons a year, which adds up to about $30,000. Carney says that last year, the airport spent about $42,000 on fuel oil. That's with low prices and a mild winter. They have in the past spent up to $70,000. And Carney says as demand for wood pellets grows, the price of that renewable fuel should drop even more. Ketchikan High School is next in line to get biomass boilers and will need about 11 times the volume of pellets as the airport. Peterson says she'd like to see more people using pellet boilers for home heating as well. She uses it herself and says it works great.
It takes a shifting in your attitude if you want to go ahead and heat with wood. But I tell you what, I'd rather know where my fuel was coming from, you know, and I can see my fuel source out my window.
Part of the problem is that wood stoves of the past weren't efficient and created a lot of smoke, leading to a bad reputation. Wood pellet boilers are much more efficient now. Carney says he's observed other wood pellet boilers in action.
There was no smoke.
Yeah.
I mean, you can stick your hand into the stack, pull it out, and not smell any smoke or see any smoke.
To improve the image of biomass to visitors, the building that houses the airport's new boiler will serve as an ambassador of sorts, with windows so people can see the boiler at work.
I like these windows.
Yeah, so that'll go get uncovered. The idea there is people will be able to look in here. Like I say, this will all be painted, and there'll be a storyboard outside that tells how this works, and so the traveling public will be able to
see that.
Yeah.
Well, that's so cool.
The entire project cost, including the design, was about $950,000, all paid for through grants. Carney says the Alaska Energy Authority provided the bulk, and the rest was a legislative grant that incorporated the federal woody bug. Once the new boiler is fired up and pumping out heat, Carney says he plans to host a ribbon-cutting celebration and invite everyone who's helped move the project along. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
And for KFSK News, I'm Tom Abbott.